What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram. Stunt you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam. Put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang. Y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. Now, on today's episode, we have got on a singer, an author, founder of a charity called Starchild, and this is Michaela Foster Marsh. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Zippy. It's lovely to be here.
Happy to have you on. So I've done a real brief intro right there, but for people who may not be familiar with who you are, tell them a little bit about you and what you do.
Well, as you said, I'm a singer, a songwriter, and I have three albums, most of which were recorded in Canada, where I lived for about 18 years. And most recently, I went into the world of writing. Well, not really recently. I mean, it takes such a long time to write a book, but I've now got three books that I've written. And the first one to be published is actually my memoir. It's a very candid memoir about growing up with my adopted Ugandan brother, Frankie, in the late 60s until he died at the age of 27 in a house fire. And 18 years after, I ended up finding his family in Uganda. It was a bit of a long pilgrimage to get there, but I decided I wanted to find the family in Uganda. And I've been doing a lot of writing about a fictional character, very loosely based on his mother, who gave him up for adoption. And after my mum died, I came across all the paperwork. My family had all gone by that point, and I came across the paperwork on Frankie's adoption, and it just set my imagination going. For many years, it just seemed like I wasn't meant to go, and the universe definitely has its own timing on things, and I speak about that in the book. But so 18 years later, I find myself in Uganda, and through nothing short of a miracle, just miraculous, divine synchronicities, the things that happened, I ended up meeting his family and now have three adopted Ugandan brothers. You know, I call them my brothers, they call me their sister. So from there, I then set up a charity in memory of my brother, having seen some of the poverty and met a lot of people out there in Uganda. I didn't want to just meet them and then leave and just come back. So it just took on its own life, and since then I've been running the Starchild charity, and it's just, it's gone from strength to strength. We built a school for creative arts in Uganda. We work with, there's about 110 kids at that school, and then we're in the process of building a sanctuary for children with autism and disabilities, because in Uganda the stigmas and myths surrounding children with disabilities and autism is pretty horrendous. So we've been working in that area as well now, and in memory of my beloved partner, Ronnie, who died last year. So, working away through a lot of grief with that. But it's good to have the focus of the charity and then to be able to do the work in memory of Ronnie, just like I did with Frankie.
Okay, well,
So that's
there okay.
where we're at now.
Okay, gotcha. Well, there's a lot there, so there's a lot to go more in depth on. So, tell us a little bit more about your backstory. So, you grew up in Glasgow, is that right? Okay.
We grew up. I grew up with a black brother who was adopted. He was my twin. We were pushed around Scotland and Glasgow in a twin pram in 1968, which was highly unusual. I mean, people just hadn't seen transracial adoption at that point. But my parents hadn't set out to adopt a black child. They had put on the application form that they would take a hard-to-place child, meaning a child maybe with a disability or an older child. And the adoption agency came back and said, well, actually, we have a little black boy who's been here for 13 months and he's hard to place. Would you consider, a black child? And my parents said, well, they didn't really care about the colour of the child's skin as long as they felt there was a bond with the child. So they went out to visit Frankie at Tanker Hall Children's Home in Kilmarnock, just outside Glasgow. And I think it was love at first sight. But the adoption agency were very concerned that Frankie and I were identical in age. There was only 4 weeks between us. So they thought there could be territorial issues and, they had to be careful with that. So I did have an older brother, 8 years older, but Frankie and I, that was the main concern was around, us bonding. So he came as a foster and there was no territorial issues at all. I mean, from what my mum said, I just guided him around like a little mother. And so the adoption went through very quickly within a year. But I suppose if we think back to that time, it was very brave of my parents because at that point there was all the tensions in the civil rights movement in America. Martin Luther King had just been assassinated. And I guess my parents took a kind of very quiet anti-racism stance and adopted Frankie at a time when it was, like I say, it was very unusual to see a black and a white child together and black children being introduced. I mean, transracial adoption has become increasingly, I guess, more popular and acceptable. But at that time, I think it was unusual. I wouldn't have said that we suffered a tremendous amount of racism, to be honest, at that point. It was curiosity. People were really curious as to why there was this black child with a white child, milk bottle white, freckly skinned child and this black. So people would stop my mum in the street and they would want to hold Frankie. They'd want to hug him and touch him and touch his hair. And I think that for mum, if I'm honest, which I mean, I am in the book, I talk quite openly about this. My mum's difficulty, I don't think she expected that and wasn't prepared for that. And I think that for her, she had just not long had me. So if you think about it from a new mother's point of view, and then everybody's looking at her black child and ignoring her own child. I mean, I'm not looking for the sympathy vote here. It's just that for my mum, I don't think she expected so much of it to be, grab so much attention. And she'd be thinking, why are people not looking at Michaela? They're all looking at Frankie. And so that was quite difficult for her. But these are all, there's a lot of things I cover in the book about adoption itself and some of the traumas. And my father was adopted and my ex-husband were adopted and obviously Frankie. So I do cover a bit about adoption in the book as well and about the abandonment issues and things and sometimes, the parents, the difficulties some parents can have. And again, I'm not really, I'm not an expert on racism, and I'm not out to, I've got no political motivation in this. I couldn't have predicted the timing of the book, for it to have come out now is quite bizarre. But then if you read the book, the timing of everything, the way the universe, God synced it all up, it's just absolutely astounding. And I think that's what people are finding so amazing about the book. But obviously because of the political state at the moment and the racism and where we're at, and the hark back to 68 at that time. Mm-hmm. And my parents having adopted Frankie at that time, and then looking at what's happening now in the world, I suppose the timing is quite incredible. But little did we know, you know, or when I was writing the book, that this would be, you know, even remotely getting talked about. I mean, I remember saying to people, you know, my parents had taken a sort of quiet anti-racism stance in 68 by adopting Frankie, and it kind of just went over people's heads. They weren't really, what was going on in 68, you know, it didn't really arouse people's interest. And now suddenly it's become something that people are hooking onto with the book. And yet the book is so much more. But yes, it does obviously touch on the racism that we experience, but also the grace that we experienced and the blessings and the wonderful, what a wonderful story.
Yeah, you know,
it's a great story, and amongst all this other angst and you know, anger that's around, I hope that it shows another side to that.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, so of course this is going back a while now. So I mean, growing up in Glasgow, I guess through the 70s, through the 80s, having a black brother, what was your experience like? So you've talked a little bit about what it was like for your mother and perhaps the family when you were at a baby, but of course we don't really remember being babies at all. We hear the stories and everything like that. But from when you were, I guess, getting a little bit older, you know, 4 or 5, and then of course growing up, going to school, going through your teens, etc., what was your, of course, I know this will all be in the book, but what was your experience like? What was your experience like, and what was your brother Frankie's experience like?
Well, like you say, you know, I don't have memory of my first memory. I don't remember looking at Frankie going, oh, you're black, you're different from me. You know, children aren't born with that sense. It's just, he's my playmate. He's in a pram with me and we do everything together. Probably the first time that I realised there was an issue or that Frankie felt different was when we were in the bathtub together and we were about 5 years old. We used to get in the same bathtub. And he turned around to my mum and said, if I scrub really hard, will I become white like Michaela?
Oh.
And I mean, even at 5, my 5-year-old sensibilities recognized that, you know, Frankie feels different here. Mm. And I mean, I remember turning around and saying, oh, I hate my freckles. I wish I could scrub my freckles off. And that was the truth. I really did. You know, I didn't like my freckles. I used to hate my freckles. And Mum would say they're a sign of beauty. So Mum went on and sort of explained to Frankie that, you know, about the melanin in the skin and how he had so much more melanin in his skin. And that's, you know, his biological family came from Africa and it was very hot there. And, you know, Michaela has this uneven distribution of melanin in her skin. And, you know, that's why you're black, and you know, you can't basically scrub that away, and why would you want to, and be proud and everything. And I remember my mum talking about Africa and me becoming really fascinated by the fact that my brother came from this exotic country. She made it sound so exotic. And I think then at that point in my life, I was almost getting prepared that I was going to go to Africa one day. Mm-hmm. You know, this was part of where I wanted to go because I had so much curiosity around Frankie. But the thing was that Frankie did not have that curiosity. What happened was, I remember we sat down, my dad one night brought out this folder. And he said to Frankie and myself, we were always included in the conversation, did Frankie want to know anything about his African family and before he came to us? And Frankie got quite upset and quite defensive. And he said, they didn't want to know me. I don't want to know them. I'm Scottish. I'm not African. I don't want to go there. And my dad, you know, was very sensitive to this. And he just basically said, okay, we don't have to discuss this. It's just that the folder's there. We don't have very much information to go on because, you know, adoption was often cloaked in secrecy at that time. So there really wasn't much to go on. But my dad said, you know, if you want to find out anything, we'll help you. Just know that if you ever want to talk about it, we'll talk about it. And you know, the information that we have is here for you when you're ready. So I knew then that Frankie didn't want to talk about it. I think there might have been a fear in a 10-year-old head that maybe he could get sent back there.
Okay.
You know, that maybe he would end up having to go to a country that he couldn't really identify with. Mm. At that time in his life anyway, he saw himself very much Scottish. He had a white family and he loved us. And we were all he'd ever known. So he may have had, I don't know 100%, because we didn't discuss it, because again, that whole adoption thing, it was very obvious Frankie didn't want to talk about it. So it wasn't until he got older that he started to want to address that. But at that point, in the 10-year-old mind, it was a closed subject. And for me, I was still left going, what's in that folder? You know, what I want to know about my brother's family, because he was that close to me. It was like he was like my biological twin. And, you know, if he had these parents, then they were kind of like my parents. And so I wanted to know who they were. But I didn't talk about it. So he was oddly incurious about it. And yet I was so overly curious, really. And so I think that's where I used my imagination in the book, that's the second book, which actually was the first book written, but it will be published secondly. But getting on a bit, when Frankie was very popular. He was the only black guy at secondary, okay. At high school. And he was very comfortable in the school environment. He had a lot of friends. He didn't have a chip on his shoulder. He didn't play the victim mode at all, despite the fact that he had plenty to maybe feel, you know, a bit oppressed by. He didn't use that at all. He just a great personality, a great sense of humor. He didn't take himself too seriously, and he didn't go looking for trouble. Mm-hmm. Trouble did sometimes find us, unfortunately. As we got older, I think more, I mean, he got pulled out of school a couple of times. He had been arrested for crimes that he didn't commit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it was, you know, he was black. There was another guy who was black that wasn't a particularly pleasant character, unfortunately. And Frankie was always getting pulled up and arrested. And when he did, the police would just say, oh, well, they all look the same to us.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So in a situation essentially where he was like one of the only people who looked that way, then. Yeah, no, I can understand that. That's a weird situation, because it's sort of like, I don't know, in a way it's racism, but also in a way it's like, it's just sort of being a super duper minority, right? Like if you're there's another person who's 6'10" and you're the only two people who are 6'10" and they're looking for someone who's that height, then, yeah, people make all sorts of snap judgments and prejudices and things like that. And then, of course, you know, there can be the racist, direct racism element as well. So, yeah, no, I get that. But, yeah, carry on.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that, you know, my dad had a clerical collar on. He was white. I do think that the minute he went down to the police station, the situation got resolved very quickly.
Yeah.
And I do wonder if that wasn't the case, would it be resolved so quickly? Mm. But my dad would very much say to Frankie, much what you're saying to me, you know, we try not to make a big issue of it, you know. And I think because we didn't make a big issue of it and didn't say, you know, or accuse them of being racist or anything like that, you know, the situation always seemed to calm down, you know, very quickly, which I think was good, and was good for Frankie as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, my dad grew up with stigma. I mean, he was called the local B because he was adopted and didn't know who his father was. So in the time that he grew up, he had a lot of stigma against him socially because he didn't have a father, you know, and he didn't know at that time who his mother was.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he had to come up against, you know, some hardship in life as well. And so he'd never made a big deal of it with Frankie. And I think that rubbed off on Frankie, that ability to kind of just okay, let it roll, you know. But it was embarrassing for him. And I remember being extremely upset when it happened, when he got arrested at school and running across the telephone booth and phoning my dad in tears. And it wasn't nice. It wasn't pleasant. But I agree with what you're saying. You know, when you're only in a minority like that, it's easily done. Yeah. Then as we got into the clubs and the bars and the pubs, I mean, there'd be places you go in and somebody wouldn't want to serve him because of the color of his skin, you know.
Yeah. And what sort of timing would this be? This would be like in the...
This would be in the 80s.
Early 80s?
80s, 90s, 90s, okay. late 80s, 90s.
Okay.
I mean, he died in 94 at the age of 27. And I would have said, like, in our, you know, late teens, there would be a couple of there was one incident at a party where a guy pulled a knife out. And it was the most terrifying night of my life. And I do speak about that in the book. And I do not know to this day how Frankie managed it, but he talked his way around with this guy. And he also had a big support group. He had friends that would have defended him to the death.
Yeah.
He was, like I say, very, very popular. So I'm talking about racism, but it was the minority. The majority of people loved and accepted Frankie. Over 800 people came to his funeral. Wow. You know, you couldn't get in the church for people. He wasn't famous. He was just this local guy and everybody loved him. But there were people who took offense to the color of his skin. And you know, there was last night where the knife got wielded in front of us. And I don't know how Frankie managed to do it, but he just was like, I'm not looking for trouble, da 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 da. And you know, he could fight if he had to. Again, my father taught him how to throw a punch. He'd been in the boxing ring in his youth. You know, he was not averse to that if necessary, but he didn't go looking for trouble, Frankie. And we were able to somehow get ourselves out of that. But I was hysterical. I thought he was going to be murdered.
Yeah. What happened in that situation? Because that sounds...
I mean, that's what I'm saying. My memory is really shady about what happened. I get pulled out from the party.
Yeah.
And there had been a gang, basically, that were kind of, you know, when I say a gang, not an official gang, just a group of kids mulling around and whatnot. And I think they had far too much to drink. And, you know, it was like just looking for a fight.
Yeah.
And Frankie was there. He was, you know, they were calling him, you know, Black Bee and all the horrible language. And his friends had come out and somebody ran out to get me and said that, you know, somebody has got a knife, they're going to kill Frankie, which, I mean, I was just in a terrible state. But what happened, I have no idea. I remember just kind of screaming, please leave him alone, leave him alone. He hasn't done any harm. He hasn't done you any harm. And anyway, the guy, eventually the guys went off, but the guy was standing in front of him with a knife. And Frankie was just right, trying to kind of calm the situation and say he wasn't looking for any trouble. And his friends were just kind of saying, look, guys, it's not worth it. Come on, like, just calm down, you know. And his friends tried to pull the guy, their own friend, away that had the knife,
which
was good. You know, they could see that this was going to lead to real trouble. Yeah. But to live through that experience, it's, you know, we never told my parents. I mean, that story is, I never told my parents. Because they would just have been frightened for us to have gone out. And they were pretty cool about us going out to clubs and bars and everything together. And, you know, they would always say to stick together. And we did, you know, as we got older, we were still always together. But I think it would have just frightened them too much. So that was in our kind of late teens, you know, maybe we would be about 15. And then in the clubs and the bars, you kind of got a wee bit of a peripheral vision. You kind of sussed out the place. Most of the bars and clubs we went to, we knew the people, we knew the places, so we didn't feel, you know, too uncomfortable. But if you went into maybe a new bar or a new place, you definitely had an awareness, let's say, you know, that there could be, and the first sign would be like if somebody's not going to serve you a drink. You know, if they start ignoring it, you know, ignoring you, and they're serving everybody else, and you've been standing there for 20 minutes, then what we would do is just go, you know what, let's just go.
Yeah.
It's not worth it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like I say, he wasn't ever looking for trouble. But I think somewhere deep inside, he must have obviously felt that. And I can only speak about what I know because I'm not Frankie. Mm-hmm. And there's enough, you know, calm black voices been given a platform today to speak about racism without me necessarily, you know, carrying that torch. But I would really like to think that the book could show a positive, you know, positive story, a beautiful story. About a child who had been adopted into a white family,
yeah.
And you know, just that love transcended all borders and time and even life itself. I mean, the love that I have for Frankie continues today. That, you know, the work that we're doing in Uganda is a testimony to that, and also just the wonderful synchronicities that have brought me to find another African family and be embraced by them all these years later.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So tell me more, a little bit more about that aspect. So you said that when did you first go to Uganda, and what's the whole story behind how that all happened? What spurred that, and how did you go about doing it?
It wasn't easy.
Okay.
It took many years, like I say, but I think there came a point where I just, you know, I completely surrendered to this. I mean, I had been working away mostly like a detective to some degree. As I say, after my mum died and my dad had died, then I inherited this paperwork, and I saw the name of, you know, opening that folder. I think I was just as curious as Frankie would have been. You know, and also nervous because you don't know what's going to be in the folder. I had so wanted this woman to have not wanted to give up Frankie. That was what I created in my head. It was the story that my parents had kind of always said, is that, you know, your mum didn't want to give you up. It was circumstances. I'm, you know, sure she loved you. But that kind of sugar-coated information, I didn't know if it was the truth or if it was just, you know, put to us to make it easier for Frankie. So when I opened the folder, I had absolutely no idea what I was going to find. So I discovered that Janet Wibugira found the name, and I just wanted to know who this woman was and everything about her. And
this is
his birth mother.
Okay.
And she was over here as a Ugandan student in 62 when Uganda got independence. It sent a lot of its really bright students from Uganda over to the UK to study. And she ended up in Belfast, and she was studying as a teacher. And it told us that her father was a pastor in Uganda, and that if she had had the child, it would have been really bad for her to have gone back to Uganda with an illegitimate child. Mm-hmm. Also, the fact that the government were paying for their education, they could not get pregnant. I mean, that was one of the big stipulations. You know, they were told all these things you couldn't do. But I mean, if the government's paying for your education and then you get pregnant during your course,
yeah.
You know, yeah. The term. So I believe what she did was she came to Scotland to have the child in secrecy. And then she went back to Belfast and then to Uganda.
Okay.
So having left the child, and I think that it was reluctant. I think she reluctantly gave up the child.
Okay. So she left. So she left Frankie with an adoption agency. Is that how it happened?
Yeah, she left him with the Church of Scotland.
Okay.
And as far as I know, this is actually another really strange thing that's happened since. In the book, I eventually managed to find out where Frankie had been placed, and he had been placed in Tanker Hall Babies Children's Home in Kilmarnock. So that information was information that was in the folder, and I went there with Ronnie just to see where Frankie had been placed. And I remember standing outside saying, I just hope the people had been kind and that they'd looked after Frankie in his first 13 months. And then lo and behold, there was an article in the Daily Mail about the book and about myself. And I got a Facebook message from this woman who was her husband. His mother was the lady who looked after the home and looked after Frankie.
Oh, wow.
And he actually ended up phoning me and we spoke about it. And he said he was 10 at the time. And he said he just wanted to let me know that Frankie had been really loved, so much so that his mother had actually wanted to adopt Frankie.
Oh, wow.
And that he remembered overhearing a conversation between him and between his mother and father that he shouldn't have been hearing. And the mother was really upset, saying, I don't want to let Francis, he was called Francis, go. And the father said, but if you adopt him, all the other children here are going to think you should adopt them. Mm. And what's wrong with them? And we're going to have so many children come through here and we can't do that. We need to let them go. So she was concerned about where he was going, you know, and there's me all these years later. And then I get, you know, a Facebook message in our world of technology. These people find me and they're able to tell me that Frankie was so much loved in these early days. And they also told me what I'd always suspected and what I'd written in my first book, is that she came to visit him. So she probably shouldn't have been coming to visit him from what I understand, but I think that this man's mother bent the rules a bit, and Frankie's mum actually visited him on a couple of occasions in the home. Mm-hmm. So she really did not want to give him up, and which is also something that I was able to find out, you know, from having published the book, you know, that the mother had actually visited him, which I had written fictionally. But so many things that I had actually written fictionally were truth. I mean, I had placed a fictional character at Gyaza High School because I basically did a search on schools, good schools in Uganda and, you know, near Kampala and all the rest of it. And I found Gyaza High School for Girls, placed her there, and it turned out that she actually went to that school. I placed her there as a teacher. You couldn't make up half of the stuff that actually has happened. You know, it's stranger than fiction. Mm. And there I was sitting at Gyaza High School for Girls in 2011. And she had been there in 1948. And, you know, I'm sitting there looking at a picture of his mother for the very first time. And I had actually written about something fictional that was actually the truth. So the journey is still unfolding all the time. There are bits and pieces of the jigsaw coming to light. But you could never have predicted that in a million years. And then, of course, like I say, this boy saying to me, or this man now, he's saying it's my dad's 90th birthday today and I can't believe I'm talking to Francis's sister, you know, Frankie's sister. And, you know, his father and mother were both dead. And he said, I just know they would be just so happy to know that Frankie ended up in a really good family. And I can't believe you've written this book about his life and your life and all the work you're doing in Uganda. And he said, I used to push him around in a pram when I was 10 years of age and I just adored him.
No.
So, yeah, Frankie was well adored and loved in his life, you know. Very much so.
Okay. So when did you make your first trip to Uganda and how did that come about?
2011. Okay. I had a major agent interested in the book, not this one, that this is the true story, mm-hmm. But the Mutoki Tree. And I'd gone to London to meet with her and she said to me, you know, I can't believe you've not been in Uganda and I really want to see what you do with this book if you actually get to Uganda, because she wanted me to work in an edit. So I said, I've actually been trying to go to Uganda for a number of years and I keep getting delayed and delayed and setbacks and delays. But I mean, I'm a great believer in prayer and meditation and there was little signposts along the way that I knew, despite it. I mean, I was sort of saying to myself, maybe somebody doesn't want me to go. But it just was all about the timing. It was about the universe's timing. And when I actually got to Uganda that year after I'd met with the agent, I was like, I've got to go. She managed to open a few doors for me to speak to some people at the embassy and things like that. And then I went there with Ronnie and I was honestly like a puppet. It was as if somebody had planned that entire trip from my life from day one, is if somehow there was, I can't think of the word, just like a divine magic about it, something. The people that I met, the way I met the family. I mean, for an example, when I went to Gayaza High School, I had an interview with the head teacher there. And I mean, I'm writing a fictional book at this time. I'm not thinking I'm going to meet his family and I'm going to unfold this miraculous story. I'm hoping that there's clues. And I said to her that I believed that Pastor Wavugira, who was my brother's grandfather, was the pastor of the school in 1950 to 1960. And I'd only found that out through interviewing a missionary in Farnham, who told me that she believed that the grandfather was the pastor of her school. And then when I was sitting there, she kept saying, I know the name Wavugira, I know the name. Why do I know the name Wavugira? And 2 minutes later, this woman passed by the window and she pulled her into the office and she said, Phoebe, do you not know something about the Wavugiras? And she said, yeah. She said, they are family. I found Janet in the cupboard the other day. This woman was a relative.
Okay.
And she wasn't supposed to be there that day because it was a school holiday. She only came back to the school to pick up paperwork that she'd left behind. And I was there at that very moment.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's quite so, a coincidence.
I know, confusing. Yeah, I should have probably started. I'm maybe not explaining it very well. But this woman, the school, it was a public holiday. The head teacher said to me, I'll have more time for you in the public holiday if you want to come to the school. And I was really disappointed, thinking, oh, I won't get to see the girls. But I was like, hey, any opportunity to get there and get to meet them and everything will be fine. And then this woman shows up who had just seen a picture of Janet Wavugira in the cupboard because she'd been asked that week to, I don't believe this, my battery's running low, sorry.
Okay, no worries.
I thought I had plugged it in, it's obviously come out. This is what happens when you're live. Anyway, hopefully that's us. She'd just been asked if she would look out the old girls, photographs of the old girls.
Okay.
That very week before. So she compiled this photograph album, came across this woman, Janet Wavugira, and recognised the name because it was a relative. So she was able to then show me a picture of Frankie's mum.
Okay.
And there from then, she was like, I know the brothers. You know, I'm in touch with the brothers and the auntie. And I was like, what? So within 2 hours, I was then sitting in the company of my brother's brother, who has the same name. His name's Frank. And he looks like Frankie.
Oh, he's got the same name, did you say?
He's got the same name.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So they both get the same name. Frank, he's called Frank.
Yeah.
And then I have another brother, David. And there was another brother, Stephen. And my older brother was Stephen. Unfortunately, Stephen and his family died of AIDS in the 90s. But I have another brother, Paul, who lives in the States. Minutes from where George Floyd was murdered.
Okay.
And then I have David, who's a teacher, and then I have Frank in Uganda. And it was just the most surreal experience for me to be sitting in the company of my brother's brother 18 years after his death in Uganda.
Wow.
And my brother never set foot in Uganda. This was the first time I'd ever been in Uganda. And I was overwhelmed with emotion. I was extremely upset. And poor Frank was like, why is this white woman crying all over me? It's like this nutter from Scotland, you know? And so I had to try and explain that his brother was my brother and he lived in Scotland. And so, as much as he was...
He wouldn't have even... Was he even aware? He wouldn't have been aware that he had another brother, I presume.
No, well... Yeah. I thought that there's no way he was going to be aware of this. And okay. I was really very nervous about this because I thought, I don't want to open up Pandora's box here. I do not want to tell this family. You know, I didn't know whether Janet was alive or dead. I had been told by Phoebe by this point that that Janet had died.
Yeah.
And only months before Frankie died. And when Frankie died, I used to say to people, maybe his mum has died and wanted him back. Mm. And, you know, it is strange that his mum died and then Frankie died not that long after. But what I did discover, I mean, as much as Frank was going, oh my God, wow, 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 I cannot believe this. You know, I had a brother, you know, I just can't believe this. He had brought all this paperwork with him and he'd brought pictures of his mum and everything. And then as the conversation kind of went on and, you know, we were talking a lot more, he then explained to me that about 12 years previous, they had been told by an aunt that they had a brother in the UK somewhere, and that she was the last living one of the sisters. So seemingly Janet had told the sisters that she had a boy that she'd given up for adoption and left in the UK. And she said, when I die, I want the boys to know that they've got a brother in the UK. But there was no information to go on, nothing. Mm-hmm. And the three sisters decided when Janet died that they wouldn't tell the boys because they didn't really see any point in telling the boys. So they kept it a secret until the last aunt was dying. And then she was the one that was going to go to her grave with the secret.
Okay.
So she decided to speak to Paul, who was living in the UK at the time. He was in a gospel band called Limit X. They were doing quite well and he was living in the UK. So they phoned and said to Paul, you know, your mum had this boy, he left in the UK. And of course, Paul was like, no, you're lying. Mum wouldn't do that. And then Paul thought about it and thought, well, it is a possibility. So he kind of went on a one-man crusade to try and find Frankie with no information, and of course, got nowhere. The boys in Uganda were like, you know, mum would never give up a child for adoption. This can't be true. And then for them, 12 years later, I show up out the blue and say, well, hello, it's true. And this is your brother. And I was his sister. And this was his family. And they were absolutely just as overwhelmed as I was, could not believe that I'd found them. I mean, they're very grateful now. I mean, we work together in Uganda and we have, you know, I have these various projects. And I feel really blessed that I have been able to turn Frankie's death into something really positive, and his legacy is still going strong in Uganda, in a family that he never knew, with a culture that he never knew. And, you know, just shortly before he died, he had been saying that he was interested in finding out about his family, and he'd written to my dad. He was living in London at the time. And I have to say, I think from what I understand, he suffered more racism in London than he did in Scotland. So, but I wasn't there at the time and I was living in Canada. He came back to Scotland not long before he died, and he had just been starting to become interested in finding his family when he died.
Okay.
So I kind of took that torch up and eventually I found them. And I think that, again, the timing of that, you know, as much as I might have wanted to find them earlier, for whatever reason, you know, something greater knew, a bigger plan to it. And I think they were ready, I was ready. And now, of course, with the book, you know, hopefully the timing of that is positive as well.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's a super interesting story. I mean, what's your relationship like now then with his with his siblings? Do you know them well now and everything like that? Have you bonded with them?
I do. Yeah, I mean, we do call each other family, and I love it when they call me sister. At first, I was like, you kind of have to, you know, earn that, yeah. You know. And it was very different. I think, obviously, you know, that I'm this white person, and there is that whole perception of us being really super wealthy, the Mzungu with all the money. Mm-hmm. And I think they definitely thought, oh, we've won the jackpot, you know, we've got this rich, wealthy sister, you know, she's done all this singing and all the rest of it. And, you know, anybody who lives in the arts knows what the arts is really like, you know, it's a struggle to survive on a daily basis. Sure. But even though you might have awards or whatever else, you're still, you know, struggling to survive. But I think as time's gone on, they realise that, you know, that's not who I am, and it's not what I'm about. but that I really wanted to do what I could to help. And I noticed a gap in the education system with the arts. You know, the arts are so important, mm-hmm. and they are missing in some countries like Uganda. There's a real focus, maybe you'll know from your Nigerian upbringing, there's a lot of focus on the three R's and, you know, getting good marks and, you know, getting a good education.
I don't even know, when you said the three R's, I was thinking, I don't even know what that stands for.
Reading, writing, arithmetic. Big, maybe it's an old fashioned statement.
Okay, two of them don't even begin with R, that's quite funny.
I know, that's what they call them.
Fair enough. When you said it, I was like,
Reading, writing, and arithmetic.
I was like, that's 66% wrong right there. But okay.
Yeah, I know, it's mental, but that's what they call it. And let me tell you, I was hopeless at the three R's. I was hopeless at all of that. So, but if you put me into any arts classes and you know, drama or music and things like that, I often excelled. Mm. So my confidence would have been in the toilet if it hadn't have been for arts programs in schools.
Gotcha.
Because I just wasn't academic. And yet all the focus is on academics in Uganda. You know, and I think there's a slight move towards the arts, but particularly in government schools. I mean, I remember I was in one school and, well, what more than one, I saw there was children that just were not faring very well. Mm-hmm. They were being kind of just pushed aside and they looked a bit miserable like I did at school. And I could kind of identify with them. And I remember saying to a teacher, you know, what's wrong with the child? And she said, oh, he's just stupid. And I remember getting called stupid at school and how it took years to kind of go over that. Yeah. Really, I did. I had to work quite hard on myself at pushing that, you know, because the kids laugh at you and, you know, I wasn't clever at school. So I really recognized that in this child in particular. And I said to the teacher, how do you know if you put a guitar into his hand that he's not going to be a famous Ugandan guitar player, or a paintbrush, that he's not going to be, you know, Uganda's answer to Picasso, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And she said, well, I don't have money for pencils, let alone paintbrushes. And so at that point, I think the idea was initially to do a school, and it was just becoming more and more apparent that the missing link, the thing in the schools that I felt was missing, was the arts. Mm-hmm. So we then decided to try and start an arts school where children would be introduced to all of the different arts disciplines. And that's basically what we did. But it took a bit of courage, I think. I didn't know the first thing about starting up a charity. And I just had to keep pushing through a lot of fears. Because people are giving you the money, and you're dealing with a country like Uganda. I mean, gosh, as we're finding out, I don't think it matters where. There's corruption everywhere in governments, but I think, you know, it is notoriously quite bad there. And you know, being linked in with the education system wouldn't be easy. And so I was kind of learning on my feet the whole time about how to work in the country and navigate a very complex system. Mm-hmm. It works very, very differently over there from how we operate. Education systems different, the rules and regulations. So we had to kind of learn, I had to learn how to navigate that. And I think it was good to have the boys as a sort of sounding board, but I mean, they didn't quite understand their mad red-headed Muzungu sister. Because they worked different, they hadn't been outside of Uganda. So there was lots of frustrations, lots of things to overcome, lots of challenges. But I think now there's a much better understanding we have of each other's cultures and you know, which has been great. I just find it interesting and challenging. And I love getting to know Africa. I love getting to know that culture. And I would really love them to come here one day and see where Frankie grew up. It would be great to be able to have that opportunity as well. So I go out there as often as I can and see the various projects. We have a number of projects that we work on in Uganda, but the school has been the big one that we managed to pull off and twinned with another school and offer the arts
That's cool. Which
is fantastic.
When was the school founded?
It opened in 2016.
Okay, fantastic. So and how many students have you got there now?
We've got about 110 kids there at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah. And we hope to do similar with the Autism and Disability Project and have a holistic centre there for the families to come together that are affected with autism and disabilities, because it became really apparent we'd wanted to obviously have the most marginalised into our school, and with the best will in the world, we just weren't able to change the myths and stigmas surrounding some of those, you know, kids. Mm-hmm. So we felt we really needed to start from a real grassroots level and start working with the communities and start sensitizing them to disabilities and autism and an understanding of it, rather than it just being a curse. Mm. Because a lot of them do believe it's a curse by the devil and they won't touch them. And so it, one of the schools that we work in, the director from there is a Ugandan. She had been a child soldier and she'd come to the UK as a refugee. She's a social worker and she understands inclusion and disabilities and whatnot. So she's been brilliant at working with us collectively to bring about some change there. But it's been a struggle. But we now have some children that are helping to feed some of these children that have got disabilities and autism. Whereas before they wouldn't even touch them, they would run. Wow. Some of the kids left the school. The parents took them out of the school because that's how bad the stigma was. But she pushed through and now we're actually making great strides. They are beginning to understand that these people have as much value as anyone else, have as much worth as anyone else. Mm-hmm. So, but it's a difficult project. It's the most challenging project that we've had to date, I would say, is working. And it's really, I think a lot of things in Africa and Uganda is about working with the community. You need to get the community on your side. But we are bringing about quite a significant change in those areas. And it's a very slow, you can't just go in and, you know, you have to be respectful of their customs and of where they are coming from. Mm-hmm. And be very gentle about making those changes. But we are getting there, but what's become obvious is that we need to provide a centre for these people, and then we can have some trainers and open up that, expand it, and hopefully then have more of an outreach to other schools and with some of the trainers from here that we would bring. And also that there are some people studying special needs in Uganda. The government is being forced to address inclusion and disabilities, which is a good thing. So hopefully we can bring about a bit of a change in that area as well.
Gotcha. And so you've also got a charity which has the same title as your latest book. It's called Star Child.
Yeah.
And that's primarily based doing work in Uganda. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's the work we're doing, the school that we've built, mm-hmm. you know, the women's projects that we have. We do the sanitary care program and now the Sunflower Sanctuary for Autism and Disabilities. So that's our big, yeah. We've been working in that now since basically I got back from Uganda. We got charitable status in 2013, mm-hmm. and then the school was built by 2016. So we've proved that we can negotiate in a complex culture,
yeah.
and one that's different. And I'm learning all the time. It's a two-way street. So are the boys learning about us as well, which is great. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. And what do you see as the future for that? What sort of outcomes are you hoping to achieve with the charity and even with the book and the future work? What's the message that you'd like people to get from it, and what would you want to build from it?
Well, I'm certainly hopeful that the book will give us a bigger platform.
Okay.
Which would be great. I mean, we're a very grassroots charity that has expanded and been able to prove that we work well in Uganda. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we built a school for £16,000 when other charities are getting quotes of over £100,000.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, I think having the boys there as well and being not afraid to ask and challenge and have questions, you know, I know that they just see the white face and the prices go up, you know, so we do, you know, that's a given. So anything I do, I just take the brothers along with me.
Yeah.
But I'm also really good. I've learned to say no. That's one of the first things in Uganda. Yeah, no, they don't like it, this white woman. it's still a patriarchal society, as you probably well know. But I mean, and then I come along and face a star child and negotiate with all these men, and they just think I'm really hard. But I mean, I get the price down from 100,000 to 16,000.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
It's a big difference. Yeah. And then, you know, we negotiate all the prices and everything. And I mean, we're fair, very fair. And yeah. Certainly we're able to make our money go a lot further than other charities. And I'm not knocking other charities, but we have a good sense of the place and a good way of working, and it's successful. And I think that we've grown slowly, and that's a great thing. And I think we're now at a stage where we can really expand, and the book has obviously come out, and that's giving us a bigger platform. People like yourself, hopefully this gives Star Child an even bigger platform to, you know, for people to hear about us, to hear about the really incredible work that we're doing. It is quite phenomenal. And there's a lot of that in the book as well. So, I mean, the book does cover adoption, race, family, the charity. It kind of has all of that in there.
Why did you decide to go with the name Star Child? Where is that from?
Well, Frankie's favorite band was Level 42.
Okay.
And there was a song called Star Child that Frankie had actually asked. He said to me one night, we were out in a bar, if anything ever happens to me, the song came on the radio, and he said, if anything ever happens to me, I want this song played at my funeral.
Oh, wow.
And I said, oh, don't be silly. Nothing's going to happen to you. This was only 6 weeks before he died.
Wow, that's crazy.
And I was over in Scotland on vacation. I was living in Canada. I had come over on a holiday, and Frankie was insistent in showing me every bar, every new bar that had opened in Glasgow. So we went out and about on that trip, and one of the nights we were sitting in the bar and the song came on, and I just sort of slugged it off, don't be silly, nothing's going to happen to you. And so when he died, I was like, what was that song, you know? And so Star Child, and so at the funeral we played the song Star Child. Gotcha. And I thought, really, what we are doing with the School for the Creative Arts and all of that is we're trying to find the star in every child. Mm-hmm. We want to find the worth in every child, the same with the disability. Like, it really, that whole name encompasses really what Star Child is about. And the lyrics of the song are so pertinent. It's just absolutely incredible. I mean, I just wept when I read the lyrics to the song. And so for me, the only thing I knew when I was starting the charity was that I was going to call it Star Child. Okay. That was like the starting point. I knew, and it just suited Frankie. He was a star child. He really was. And, you know, like I say, it's about finding the star in every child. That's mainly what our charity tries to do.
Fantastic. And it sounds like you're doing great work with it. So congratulations. If people want to find out more about the charity, or if people want to follow your work online, where can they find you?
Starchildcharity.org. They can find out information about the charity, and there's links to the book and Amazon or whatever. And my own website is michaelaonline.com. Mm-hmm. So very accessible. Anybody can get in touch with me at all. I'm on Facebook. I don't tend to use Twitter very much. I'm on Facebook and Instagram. I'm not huge on social media, but I'm trying to get better with the book. So, but please do reach out, and I hope people buy the book and enjoy it. And it's in amongst all this angst right now, I think hopefully it shows a different side, and the love for a black and white child, and that love transcends all borders, geographical borders, and even life itself. There's a continuous thread that connects us even after death, and I think the book proves that. It proves that, you know, we don't die. That energy lives on, and Frankie's energy is living on. And I now have a whole new Ugandan family.
That's awesome. Michaela, loved hearing your story. And I hope some people will check out the book, check out your work online, and see everything that you're doing. But I think this has been a wonderful, insightful summary of a lot of it.
Thanks very much, Zibi. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram. Stuntly is destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam. Put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang. Y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.